are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your Portland dial, KBOO.FM on your everywhere on earth internet dial. Stay safe, stay sane, stay tuned. KBOO, the best in community radio.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
In 2019, U.S. Police killed 259 black people. Between 2013 and 2019, police killed a total of 7,666 people. This according to Mapping Police Violence. Overall, black people are three times more likely to be killed by police than white people. Within recent weeks, there have been a spate of police killings of black people across the United States. On March 13th, 26-year-old Breonna Taylor was murdered by police in Louisville, Kentucky. On May 25th, 46-year-old George Floyd was murdered by police in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And countless others have also been impacted, including in Brunswick, Georgia, the not killed by police, but killed by vigilantes. We have to remember Armand Aubrey. Countless others have also been impacted. While police killings of black people in the United States are certainly not a new phenomena, a nationwide and multiracial movement calling for the defunding and abolition of police quickly gaining traction. In New York City, Mayor Bill de Blasio has conceded to protesters' demands to shift funds away from the NYPD towards youth and social services. And in Los Angeles, Mayor Garcetti has said that he has tasked the city with identifying the $150 million in cuts and more money into the black community, communities of color, women, and quote-unquote people who have been left behind. And in Minneapolis, where the latest uprising against police terror began, nine members of the Minneapolis City Council said they supported defunding the city's police department and replacing it with a community-based public safety model. Across the U.S., calls for defunding and abolishing police forces are getting louder by the day. But what is the history of policing in the United States? How did it start? What impact did its history have on what is happening in policing today? What is the interrelationship between the legacy of slavery and genocide against indigenous people, policing, and mass incarceration practices of today? Will reforming the U.S. Police departments bring an end to racism in the United States? If not, what will? Let us go now to a clip, and then I'll be right back.
I believe that a change is gonna come.
A plea for humanity in Houston.
No more hate crimes, please. Someone said, make America great again. But when has America ever been great?
As the family of George Floyd laid their loved one to rest.
Tim, I love you, and I thank God for giving me my own personal Superman.
But not their cause.
I will fight, because I've been fighting for them, and I will keep on fighting for them.
Floyd, who died after calling out for his mother from under a policeman's knee,
Mama,
will now be buried next to her.
She got her hands wide open. Come here, baby. Every mama felt that.
Floyd, he said, I can't breathe, and called for his mother. He was calling for all of us mothers. All of us.
The families of Eric Garner, Ahmaud Arbery, and Michael Brown in Houston to show their support. And former Vice President Joe Biden sent a video message.
We cannot leave this moment thinking we can once again turn away from racism that stings at our very soul.
George Floyd!
After 15 days of some of the largest national protests in recent history, changes are underway.
In this city, we will ban chokeholds and strangleholds.
Defund!
NPD!
Defund!
NPD!
In Minneapolis, a majority of city council members moved to disband the police department.
The Minneapolis Police Department cannot be reformed.
Defund the police!
In Los Angeles, Mayor Eric Garcetti has proposed cutting up to $150 million from the proposed police budget as the LAPD bans the use of so-called chokeholds.
Heads up!
In New York, Mayor Bill de Blasio says he will redistribute some of the nearly $6 billion police budget toward social services.
We will now kneel for our moment of silence.
In D.C. Monday, some congressional Democrats took a knee and introduced a sweeping national police reform bill. And some monumental movement in the Deep South. This Confederate statue hauled away in Jacksonville, Florida. But in the former capital of the Confederacy, Richmond, Virginia, this 12-ton statue of General Robert E. Lee is proving harder to move.
When it's the biggest thing around, it sends a clear message. This is what we value the most. But that's just not true anymore.
A judge has blocked the governor's request for removal, at least temporarily.
We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. And that clip you just heard was from CNN. But now we're going to go to our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Michelle Obama urged Americans to vote for Joe Biden as if, quote, our lives depend on it. Former presidential rival Bernie Sanders warned President Trump was leading the nation to authoritarianism. The two headlined last night's opening of the first ever virtual Democratic National Convention.
If you think things cannot possibly get worse, trust me, they can and they will if we don't make a change in this election.
We're facing the worst public health crisis in 100 years and the worst economic collapse since the Great Depression. We are confronting systemic racism and the enormous threat to our planet of climate change. And in the midst of all of this, we have a president who is not only incapable of addressing these crises, but is leading us down the path of authoritarianism.
Philanese and Rodney Floyd led a moment of silence in honor of their brother, George Floyd, killed by Minneapolis police. Several Republicans also made appearances to stump for Biden, former Ohio Governor John Kasich, California businesswoman Meg Whitman, former New Jersey Governor Christine Whitman, and former New York Congresswoman Susan Molinari. Tonight, New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez gets a minute to speak to the convention. Also speeches from former President Bill Clinton and from Jill Biden. Embattled Postmaster General Louis DeJoy will testify next Monday before Congress, along with the chair of the Postal Service Board of Governors. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is calling her chamber back into session over the crisis at the Postal Service, amid growing evidence that the White House is trying to undermine the agency ahead of the election. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, though, declined growing calls to bring senators back to Washington. He distanced himself from President Trump's attack on voting by mail, but McConnell said the Postal Service is going to be just fine. But in late-breaking news, the Senate Homeland Security Committee said DeJoy will testify before it on Friday, getting a jump on the House hearing. The Department of Interior has approved an oil and gas leasing program within Alaska's pristine Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The refuge is home to polar bears, caribou, and other wildlife, including migratory birds. It is also part of the ancestral range of the Gwich'in people. Interior Secretary David Bernhardt called the fossil fuel leasing program a significant step in determining where and under what conditions oil and gas development will occur there. Environmental groups immediately assailed opening the refuge and promised litigation. Alaska Native groups are also expected to sue. California's electricity managers avoided imposing a third day of rolling blackouts yesterday. They credited conservation efforts by residents who abided by pleas to trim back air conditioner use and to avoid running major appliances during the late afternoon and evening. But they warned the threat of outages will remain today as triple-digit temperatures persist in many areas of the state. California Governor Gavin Newsom said California is working with large commercial energy users, asking them to reduce consumption during peak hours. He said the state should have planned better amid the certainty it would and will face energy challenges.
This is not the last, quote-unquote, record-breaking historic heat dome and experience that we will have in this state or in this region or in this nation or in our hemisphere in our lifetime. Quite the contrary. This is exactly what so many scientists have predicted for decades.
Tens of millions of people from Arizona, up the west coast of the U.S., and Canada have been suffering from the sizzling heat. A strong earthquake has jolted the central Philippines, killing at least one person, injuring dozens, and damaging homes and buildings used for coronavirus quarantine. The magnitude 6.6 quake also damaged roads, bridges, and a port. A federal judge has blocked the Trump administration from enforcing a new regulation that would roll back health care protections for transgender people. The regulation from the Department of Health and Human Services was finalized days after the Supreme Court barred sex discrimination against LGBT individuals on the job. The rule was to take effect today and would have allowed discrimination in health care. But New York federal judge Frederick Block said the Trump rules were contrary to this summer's Supreme Court decision. He also said the Department of Health and Human Services acted arbitrarily and capriciously in enacting them. I'm Eileen Alfandary for Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We have Dr. Gerald Horn waiting in the wings. There's a lot that we have to discuss today. Our guest today, Dr. Gerald Horn, and also Joseph Williams for our Campaigners for Black Lives series. He is an organizer with Black Lives Matter LA. They've been very, very active with massive protests happening in the city of Los Angeles. What I'd like to do now is to go to a clip so you could hear Malcolm X and the message that he was sending. It seemed like so long ago, but it's so very relevant to what is happening today. Let's go to hear the voice of Malcolm X right now.
I would like to make a few comments concerning the difference between the Black Revolution and the Negro Revolution.
Yes, sir.
There's a difference. First, what is a revolution? Sometimes I'm inclined to believe that many of our people are using this word revolution loosely, without taking careful consideration what this word actually means and what its historic characteristics are. When you study the historic nature of revolutions, the objective of a revolution, and the result of a revolution, and the methods used in a revolution, you may change words. You may devise another program. You may change your goal, and you may change your mind. Look at the American Revolution in 1776. That revolution was for what? For land. How was it? Why did they want land? Independence. How was it carried out? Bloodshed. The Russian Revolution. What was it based on? Land. The landless against the landlord. How did they bring it about? Bloodshed. You haven't got a revolution that doesn't involve bloodshed. And you're afraid to bleed. I said you're afraid to bleed. Please. There's been a revolution, a black revolution, going on in Africa. In Kenya, the Mau Mau were revolutionaries. They were the ones who made the word Uhuru. They were the ones who brought it to the fore. The Mau Mau, they were revolutionaries. They believed in scorched earth. They knocked everything aside that got in their path. And their revolution also was based on land, a desire for land. So I cite these various revolutions, brothers and sisters, to show you, you don't have a peaceful revolution. You don't have a turn the other cheek revolution. There's no such thing as a nonviolent revolution. Only kind of revolution that's nonviolent is the Negro revolution. The Cuban revolution, that's a revolution. They overturned the system. And the white man is screaming because he sees revolution in Latin America. How do you think he'll react to you when you learn what a real revolution is? A revolutionary wants land so he can set up his own nation.
That's right.
An independent nation.
That's right.
These Negroes aren't asking for no nation. They're trying to crawl back on the plantation. When you want a nation, that's called nationalism. If you're afraid of black nationalism, you're afraid of revolution. And if you love revolution, you love black nationalism.
And there you heard Malcolm X in the speaking in his period as a black nationalist. I quickly want to move on to welcome our first guest for this hour, Dr. Gerald Horn, very well known to all of you, the Moores Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's written more than 30 books, including White Supremacy Confronted, U.S. Imperialism and Anti-Communism versus the Liberation of Southern Africa from Rhodes to Mandela. And he has, another brand new book that is just dropping. Dr. Gerald Horn, welcome, and tell us about this brand new book.
The brand new book is entitled For the Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. And I dare say it speaks to issues we're discussing this morning, even though I'm talking about events that unfolded 500 years ago.
And that's exactly why we wanted you on today, Dr. Horn, because the movement now, many people are saying that the killing of George Floyd is reminiscent of sparking a movement in the way the killing of Emmett Till sparked a movement. But what a lot of people don't know, getting back to the history you just referred to, and there's a lot we can discuss about that history, but let us just start with policing in the United States and its early roots, and also how you think that manifests itself today, Dr. Horn.
Urban police departments and police departments generally had their roots with regard to so-called slave patrols. Slave patrols were not only designated corps of Euro-American men who were designed to return escaped slaves to the plantation or to their so-called masters, but these slave patrols also deputized the entire Euro-American community. That is to say, they could also return these escaping Africans to their so-called masters, and then they were incentivized because they were given rewards for doing so. I should mention another point, Margaret, that I think is relevant. In the past few days, I've done a number of interviews with German television, Canadian television, Russian, Turkish, Iran, Israel this afternoon. But the corporate media and these cable channels have been conspicuous in their absence in calling upon what I have to say. And I think it's because one of the things that I do that I think that these foreign broadcasters find useful is connect what's going on today to the fact that the founders of the United States, when they revolted against British rule, they were seeking to preserve slavery. Even Malcolm X, in that segment you just played, did not make reference to that very relevant point. And I think that until we begin to do that, we'll always be encountering yet another George Floyd, because this particular kind of murderous attitude is baked into the cake of the slaveholders' republic, now known as the United States of America.
Back in 1704, the government leaders in Charleston, South Carolina, decided to create the colony's first slave patrol. As you say, Dr. Horn, a forerunner to today's police forces, and it gave white citizens the right to apprehend, chastise, and send home a slave who had left their master's property without permission. And I have to say, Dr. Horn, I mean, it seems as though this not only has influenced what happens with law enforcement, I mean, those with a badge and a gun, but also the kind of vigilantism that we saw people, these two white men chase down and basically lynch Armand Arbery. So I'd like you to make that connection as well, because, you know, we think of law enforcement, but not necessarily how it encourages people like those who murdered Arbery, or those protesters in New Jersey yesterday that were making fun of protesters. They were actually kneeling on the back. I don't think it was the neck of someone. Dr. Horn.
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head. That is to say, there has been a concerted effort to implicate the entire Euro-American community in this project. And I have to say that I find it surprising that a book has yet to be written on the point that one of the reasons and one of the ways the Euro-American community was kept in line was that they could be subjected to lynching too if they were to object. There is a long pattern of evidence about persecution of so-called N-word lovers, as they were then called. Of course, they didn't use that euphemism I just employed. And I thought, and I think that this was found quite intimidating and was quite successful in keeping that community in line. And then I think that there's been a total misreading of the history of the United States of America by our historians, bless their little hearts. What I mean is that they talk often about the anti-slavery enterprise, which was certainly there, meaning the abolition of slavery enterprise, led by John Brown, the Euro-American man who tried to overthrow slavery by force of arms in 1859. And certainly there was a pro-slavery faction, as evidenced by George Washington, through Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis, the president of the so-called Confederate States of America. But what's oftentimes neglected is what might have been the most sizable faction of all, which is the white man's country faction. That is to say, they have been interpreted as being anti-slavery, when actually they didn't want Negroes around altogether. And I'm afraid to say that the sainted Abraham Lincoln, for a good deal of his political career, was part of this so-called white man's country faction. Recall that he wanted to deport all the Negroes to Brazil or to Hispaniola or to whoever would take us. And the failure to understand this basic precept makes it difficult to understand this murderous policing, which George Floyd was subject to, because what he was subjected to was this concerted attempt by the police to maintain and create these so-called all-white spaces, and to use by any means necessary, to coin a phrase, to keep black people out of these so-called all-white spaces. And of course, intimidation, violence is the norm. Now, what happened to him was just an adjunct of that, which then raises the question, which activists understandably are raising as we speak, which is the nature and methods of the police, which, as you point out, have historic roots, and why it is, for example, you need four police officers to confront a man who is accused of passing a counterfeit $20 note. That's the misuse of taxpayers' resources. It's a misuse of the police authority.
Dr. Horn, I mean, tell us again, clearly in the 1793 Fugitive Slave Act, which authorized local governments to seize and return local slaves to their owners and penalize anyone who assisted a slave in his or her escape. And that was strengthened again in the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act. But when it comes to, you know, again, looking at this early history and how that bleeds into what's happening today, is that the initial, the the Fugitive Slave Act was about returning quote-unquote runaway slaves. But also, this what they did in terms of establishing that first slave patrol, it wasn't only about returning people who fled to their freedom, to try to get to their freedom, but it was also to prevent insurrections and mischiefs. That's a quote. And when you look at what's happening today, I mean, there is the analysis that during the slavery period, it was actually a long war that went on between slave owners and people who were enslaved. But a case can be made that that war, so to speak, has not ended, because here we are still struggling for freedom and against racism, Dr. Horn.
Well, you referenced the Fugitive Slave Act, and there was, of course, another passed quite notoriously in the 1850s. But what's striking about that was that it contradicted an alleged precept of Dixie, of the Southern states, which was states' rights. And yet they were trying to not only make sure that Northern states who were being pushed towards abolition would return escaping Africans, that is to say, Northern states could have no states' rights, they had to go along with Dixie, but also it led to conflict with foreign countries. One of the reasons for the so-called War of 1812, which eventuated with the Redcoats, Britain, burning down the city of Washington, D.C., sending James Madison, the U.S. president, and his garrulous spouse Dolly fleeing into the streets one step ahead of the posse. They did this in league with enslaved Africans who were then transported by the British to their new home in Trinidad and Tobago, where their descendants continued to reside. But overthrowing the government of Canada was seen as necessary because Canada, then under British rule, was accepting enslaved Africans from the United States and creating a kind of sanctuary for them. This also led to rather stormy relations with Haiti. Recall that Haiti came to independence in 1804, and Haiti immediately extended support and solidarity to enslaved Africans on the mainland of North America, and that led to a concerted effort by the U.S. authorities to either starve Haiti into submission, or from their point of view, the best case scenario was overthrowing the Haitian government and, quote, re-enslaving, unquote, the Haitians. Now, this attempt to export these murderous U.S. practices did not end with the abolition of slavery. Once again, a book needs to be written on how the United States tried to export Jim Crow and how the United States tried to ensure that countries in Europe, for example, who were not as murderous towards U.S. Negroes would be forced to do so, and they could be sanctioned if they did not impose Jim Crow regulations in their country. In other words, the United States was trying to deprive countries like France of sovereignty because France was not as gung-ho about U.S. apartheid as Washington was. This is part, I'm afraid to say, of the hidden history of the United States of America, which makes it so difficult and problematic to understand what's unfolding in our streets as we speak.
Right, and we're going to actually go to a clip putting together a few pieces of what is happening on the street, including protests that are happening around the world, and also Al Sharpton, he spoke at George Floyd's funeral yesterday, in which he talked about the grandchildren of slave masters now out on the street are protesting. But Dr. Horn, before we go to that clip, it's just that if you look at how these slave patrols were used, they could forcefully enter anyone's home, right? And I suppose without forcefully. That's what happened in the case of Breonna Taylor with this no-knock nonsense that they have, that police could just come to the house and fundamentally start shooting. And that's how she was killed in Louisville, Kentucky, in her bed. So there are a lot of connections here that can be made. And what I'd like to do now, Dr. Horn, please stay with us. Let us go to that clip, and then we'll continue our discussion with you.
I just moved to a spot in Remuera. I'm at the top floor. I have to go in the elevator. Three times already I've had racist, scared white people jump when they see me, and I smile at them. So now I gotta stay to the side and let them walk through just so they don't get scared when they see me. Why? Because I'm black. Just because I'm black. What did I do? I didn't have a choice. If I had a choice, though, I'd still be black.
Think about your loved ones. Think about what would you do if they died begging for help? What would you do if they died with a knee on their neck? How angry would you be? What I'm saying is be angry for us. Stand with us. Protest with us because we need you.
When a black person is oppressed in America or a black person is maltreated in Europe or in China, that also speaks to our reality. That no matter what we do, we are never going to be respected. It is in this country that we've seen people like Eric Ofochu shot and killed in broad daylight by an army officer. And to date, not a single file, not a single question has been asked. So when we say Black Lives Matter, we are simply talking about our reality as having a correlation with the reality of all black people in the world.
I need you to understand how painful it is to be reminded every day that your race means nothing. And that isn't the case anymore. There is never the case anymore.
Call it out. Just say something.
Rose represents such a violent legacy of colonialism, imperialism, slavery, particularly in Southern Africa. And the values that he represents are not the values that we stand by and not the values that we think should be celebrated in this community in Oxford.
The statue symbolizes that the university still hasn't shown a clear commitment to engaging with issues that black students face and to decolonizing. And for black and brown students and people of color to have to walk around this university and see these symbols of slavery and colonization is frankly quite abhorrent, I think.
Floyd could have been anybody. But then the reaction was not anything. Because somewhere I read in the Bible that God said he would pour out his spirit among all flesh. And that's why when I heard them talking about, they never thought they'd see young whites marching like they're marching now. All over the world, I've seen grandchildren of slave masters tearing down slave master statue over in England and put it in the river. I'll pour out my spirit among all flesh. I've seen whites walking past curfews saying no Black Lives Matter, no justice, no peace. I'll pour out my spirit among all flesh. You have now lived to where you've sown wickedness, and now you have to reap the wrath of those that don't want to be wicked no more. That a man sows, that shall he also reap.
All righty, and Dr. Gerald Horn is our guest. And that was a montage. Dr. Horn, as part of that clip, you heard students and over in the UK demanding that the statue of Cecil Rhodes come down. And we see that the one of Robert E. Lee in Richmond was supposed to come down, and now a judge has put a hold on it. And over in the UK, they're even debating, the movement is pushing for them to even take down a statue of Churchill. I'm wondering how significant you think all this is. I mean, you've written a book that has in it from Rhodes to Mandela. But also, if your view is that we are indeed seeing a new kind of manifestation of the civil rights movement. There's a new Wall Street, Washington Post Shar School poll that says 61% of people in the U.S. disapprove of Trump's handling of the protests, while only 35% approve. And they're saying that this is a shift because in 2014, after Michael Brown was killed, 43% only 43% of the population saw policing as a broader problem as opposed to an isolated incident. 51% of them said it was an isolated incident. But today, you're seeing that 69% of people are saying that the Floyd killing was a broader problem. And thus, you see the manifestation on the street. Your thoughts, Dr. Horn?
Well, as to whether this is a movement or a moment, whether these folks in the street will continue for some time to come and help to transform the political landscape, I would say right now that it's too soon to tell. And in any case, there's a mixed picture. On the one hand, you do have these positive signs, such as what's folding in Australia, New Zealand, Western Europe, etc. Certainly, it's a positive sign that in today's Wall Street Journal, on the editorial page, believe it or not, there is an opinion piece calling for reparations and reminding those who are forgotten that crimes against humanity, such as slavery, have no statute of limitations. And in fact, the writer then sketches and outlines a way to get to the question of reparations. This is in the Wall Street Journal, of all places. And I made reference to my appearance on Deutsche Welle, the German broadcaster. And what struck me about that interview was that the interviewer was pressing me to say that those defined as white in North America have collective guilt and collective responsibility for what has befallen Native Americans and Africans. Now, of course, he was basically doing a riff on what befell Germany after World War II when the United States rejected the idea put forward by some of us that fascism was the responsibility of the ruling class and that there was a vibrant and thriving anti-fascist movement. No, the United States said it was a collective responsibility of the entire German people. And so now you see Berlin turning the table. Where this is going to lead is unclear, but I would say as of today, given my knowledge of history, the most heartening aspect is the fact that there is a global movement unfolding.
Dr. Horn, there's a lot more we have to speak about. We are going to have to leave it there, though. But just to say, one of the things I want to speak with you more about, I got a message from the Caribbean region, you know, in solidarity with the protests, but they're also saying, will there, meaning the protesters, will the protesters' consciousness and activism extend beyond the national borders of the USA? Will they recognize and acknowledge the common humanity that they share with the billions of human beings who inhabit the nations of the so-called third world or developing world? And then it goes on to talk about how U.S. taxpayer dollars are used to kill and beat down people around the world, beginning in third world countries, the so-named third world countries, the developing world. That's a big conversation and one that I think we need to have. And for the young people who are listening right now, for everybody who are part of this movement, you're right. It remains to be seen the impact that this movement will have. Will it only be about policing? And that's an important piece, no doubt about it, but will it also grow to really confront this nation's history and racism in this country and around the world? Dr. Horn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
We're going to take a quick station break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn. Turn me round, turn.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Check us out on our website on sotrueradio.org. If you're on Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook, and our handle on Twitter and Instagram at SoTrueRadio.
What I'd like to do now is to go to our weekly Earth Minute, and then we'll go to our campaigners for Black Lives to wrap up our show.
As people across the U.S. rise up against systemic embedded racism, people are also rising up in Brazil, where the police kill an average of 17 people every day with few consequences. The racist and anti-poor policies of Bolsonaro, nicknamed Tropical Trump, have also contributed to Brazil having the third highest rate of COVID deaths in the world, a rate rising so sharply that Bolsonaro has stopped posting COVID data. And in the Amazon rainforest, Bolsonaro's racism against the indigenous peoples is enabling a rapid acceleration of logging in one of the Earth's most important biodiversity and carbon hotspots. As the dry season begins, these logged areas will be burned for industrial GMO soy plantations to feed animals in the meat industry. As more forest is lost, the dry season intensifies, leading to more severe fires in an endless loop. The insatiable global demand for meat and timber, combined with rampant racism in Brazil, is threatening the very existence of the Amazon's indigenous peoples. For the Earth Minute and the Sojourner Truth Show, this is Ann Peterman from Global Justice Ecology Project.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. I want to remind our audience that since 2009, actually, Sojourner Truth, we have been covering, doing regular coverage of the environment with our weekly Earth Minute and our weekly Earth Watch. And we can't forget the devastation of the environment, that's its relationship with coronavirus and all of this, as even as we confront and deal with this uprising happening across the United States. I would now like to go to our Campaigners for Black Lives series and welcome Joseph Williams, who is a student liaison for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, known as AFSCME. And Joseph is an organizer with Black Lives Matter LA. And I should say we do coordinate the Campaigners for Black Lives series with Dr. Melina Abdullah, who is one of the founders of Black Lives Matter LA. Joseph Williams, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Margaret.
So you all been busy, the street in LA, looking really active, looking really vibrant, packed down, all kinds of people out there. But Joseph, you and others in Black Lives Matter, you all have been at this for quite some time. And I must say it's something to hear the chant of Black Lives Matter here across the nation, including some small white towns in rural U.S. But in relation to this defunding of police, a lot of people are grappling with exactly what that means. And I want you to talk a little bit about that in terms of what that means for students, because there are a lot of school systems that are now saying, like in Minneapolis, that they want to cut their ties with law enforcement. Joseph Williams.
Yes, indeed. Thank you for bringing that up. And in addition to being with Black Lives Matter, I'm also the director of operations and campaigns with Students Deserve, one of Black Lives Matter's partners. That's a student-led youth organization in the Los Angeles Unified School District. And Students Deserve and many other organizations and really many other youth, right, and parents have been calling for an end to school policing as we know it for quite a long time now, right? We know that many folks in Los Angeles have fought against the over-criminalization of especially Black youth, but also Latinx, Indigenous, and other youth of color in LAUSD and other school districts in Los Angeles County, and have had some major wins, right? The positive behavior intervention program that Cadre and ACLU and other folks pushed for. You know, there was an end to willful defiance that many folks pushed for, right? Brothers Sons Selves Coalition, many of their partners. The Strategy Center has been working, you know, work to fight against the militarization of LAUSD. Students Deserve and other folks helped lead the fight against random searches, and we're leading the fight against pepper spray. And so all of these different folks, and led by the youth and led by youth and parent experiences, have been fighting against the over-criminalization of youth in schools. And for folks who went to schools 20 or 30, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, they might remember that there were no police in schools, right? That police in schools is a phenomenon that started to explode after Columbine, right? After, you know, was seen as one of the first mass school shootings of our time, right? Which has spawned so many others. And those have typically been in, you know, white suburban communities. However, the overwhelming explosion of police in schools have come in low-income urban communities with people of color, right? With Black folks, with Latinx folks, and other folks. So we see here in Los Angeles that the LA School Police Department is the largest school police department in the entire country, right? That LAUSD has its own school police department, which is actually larger than many police departments of entire cities, right? LA School Police Department has or spends between $60 and $80 million a year on school police. And again, a school system where 90% of the students are students of color and 80% of the students are eligible for free or reduced lunch, right? So this is an overwhelmingly you know, Black, Indigenous, people of color school district, low-income school district, and you know, the way that the school system has been responding is to over-police these students, to criminalize these students, to punish and push out these students, and really contribute to the school-to-prison pipeline, right? We know that not only does Los Angeles Unified have the largest school police department in the country, right, but also that L.A. County incarcerates more people and more youth than anyone else in the country, right? And so this system of policing in schools absolutely contributes to the incarceration, right, the over-incarceration, over-criminalization, and push-out of our young people. And so now young people at this time, right, as we're seeing around the country, like you mentioned, folks are rising up, and young people are using this time to say, our voices matter as well, right? And this isn't just something that's happening to adults in the streets. This is happening to us in our schools. And it's unacceptable, right? And as we need to call for defunding LAPD, we also need to call for defunding and abolishing, right, the LA School Police Department, and reinvesting that money in things that really will serve especially Black students, but all students in LAUSD who really need services, right, and care, and not criminalization.
From what you're saying, you see this as certainly part of the call for defunding police. I mean, getting them out of the schools would be part of that. And when you talk about the police, there's been such a rise in the militarization of police in the United States. The Pentagon's 1038 program allows law enforcement agencies to be able to get their hands on Department of Defense technology and a startling amount of heavy-duty military-grade hardware. There's also training by Israel, and we know that Palestinians in Israel are living under apartheid state and conditions, and there, the Israeli government, they have poured money and resources into training U.S. law enforcement, and that is pretty scary. And between 1997 and 2014, $5.1 billion in material was transferred from the Department of Defense to local law enforcement, with ammunition being the most common requisition. So, Joseph Williams, I mean, I remember what it was like in high school. You know, it was a long time ago. You're absolutely right. There were no police in the schools. But I know that just about every Black person I know, including myself, or brown person, but speaking for myself now, you see a police officer and you have not only an emotional reaction of the kind of fear that sets in because you don't know what's going to happen. Anything could happen, right? And you may end up dead somehow, but also the, you know, studies are increasingly showing the health impacts of racism. And when you have police officers in the schools, you've got, you know, young people that are still growing and developing. So it's not even only the threat of the school to prison pipeline, which is just horrific, but it's also just the physical and emotional impact it has on children of color, knowing very well the history, going back, as Dr. Horn spoke earlier, of slave patrols and vigilantism, and we're seeing manifested today in the behavior of law enforcement. So just some final comments from you on all this.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think part of that is because, you know, it's even more stark now because we're growing, or the youth right now, right? This generation that's in school right now has grown up and is coming of age in a time when police murder, police violence, black death at the hands of the police is almost a regular, not almost, it's a regular occurrence, right? That they've seen on their timelines, they've seen on their social media time and time and time again since they were young children, right? The police brutalizing, beating, murdering people, right? On Facebook, on Instagram, on TikTok, and in their own communities. And so absolutely, even if we're not talking about the direct harm that police are doing to certain students, they're doing so much more indirect harm, right, to the psychology and emotions and other things of these students. You're absolutely correct. And I think, you know, that's why it's so important right now that we as Black Lives Matter, Los Angeles, and that other folks around the nation are really intentionally listening to the youth, right, intentionally listening to these stories, these feelings, these experiences, because many people will come and say, well, how are we going to be safe in schools if we take away the police? But for many students, the vast majority of students, right, especially in LAUSD, where the vast majority are students of color, police don't make them feel safe in schools. Police don't make them feel comfortable in schools. They do the opposite, right? They contribute to our folks feeling more stigmatized, feeling more criminalized, feeling like there's a target on their back, because there often is. Right, we know that in LAUSD, black students make up only 8% of all students, and yet they made up about 30% of police contact and 25% of arrests. Right, so they're disproportionately represented, over three times their population rate. Right, 3 to 4 times their population rate in the terms of arrests and incarceration rates or in contact rates with LA school police. And so black students have been leading this call to say defund and abolish the school police and give us the resources that we need. It's the same call that's coming from us in the streets, right, to give us the services that our community needs and the care that our community needs rather than cops. And it's the same call that's coming from students. And so I'm blessed to be at the intersection of these movements and to be inspired by and following so much powerful youth leadership as they begin to create an entirely new world, right, and force the rest of us to be imaginative and to be creative about envisioning and building and fighting for a world with alternative forms of public safety, without police, without incarceration. And so I'm really inspired to again, follow behind the youth as they lead us in the creation of that new world.
Joseph Williams, for our listeners in other parts of the country that are hearing you right now, we know very well that what you have described in terms of LA Unified School District, this is happening across the United States, in cities across the United States, but also increasingly in small towns. I mean, in my visits, for example, in rural Illinois, which has had a history of being racist, and they've got a pandemic now of the opioid epidemic, and they're saying that their jails are overflowing. They're just full, a lot of them young people. But for people who want to get in touch with Students Deserve and support the work that you all are doing, what should they do, Joseph Williams?
Follow us on Instagram at LA_StudentsDeserve. We are currently pushing a survey for current and former LAUSD students to get folks' opinions on whether they want to defund police and what they think those resources should be going to. So we encourage folks to go to our Instagram at LA_StudentsDeserve. Also, obviously, follow BLM Los Angeles. You can follow Black Lives Matter Los Angeles and Students Deserve on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook to stay up to date with all of our most recent campaigns.
Well, Joseph Williams, thank you so much for joining us. And it's really so heartening to see the bravery of young people out on the streets in a time of pandemic, you know, risking life and limb. We appreciate you, Joseph, and thank you for being on the show and all of the work that you do. Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret. Alrighty. And thank you for continuing to use your platform to demand justice.
Alrighty, that's right. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're out of time. Today's show produced by me, that's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank all of today's guests, Dr. Gerald Horn, Joseph Williams. I'd like to thank our audio engineer, Ricky Herrera, our assistant producer, Romero Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. Go online to Pacifica Radio Archives. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Y'all stay safe now. Thank you.
KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Also heard at Translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM and Translator K282BH.